I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In 2013, Kansas privatized its Medicaid system, resulting in CanCare, its alternative. Since then, hospitals across the state have closed, confusion has abounded, and still more than 150,000 residents don't qualify for the state program and can't afford coverage otherwise. Today, we'll ask two men who administer the program what's being done to maintain and improve CanCare. Then, we spend some time with one of my favorite sports, basketball. A new book offers an unprecedented history of the game and tries to get at what basketball means to so many who love it. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In 2013, then-Governor Sam Brownback announced his plan for turning Medicaid in Kansas into a privatized system. He called it CanCare. But since its beginning, CanCare has gotten heavy criticism. The application process was confusing. It took weeks to hear back. Some providers won't accept CanCare patients. Even today, lawsuits involving the program have complicated things. So to find out if CanCare is working the way it's supposed to and to ask what improvements are needed and which have been made, today we're speaking with Jeff Anderson. He's Secretary for the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. CanCare falls under the KDHE roof, so to speak. Jeff, welcome. So nice to have you.
Good morning.
John Hamdorf is also here. He's the Medicaid Director for the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. John, nice to have you too.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jeff, first, why don't you explain to us in broad strokes here how CanCare works? I know it's different from other states, and not everyone listening out there may be a Medicaid expert.
Yes, so KDHE, as you indicated, is the state agency that oversees the Medicaid program. Since 13, as you articulated, we have partnered with three managed care organizations to help administer the program. And as I think you kind of were alluding to, we are making a change effective at the beginning of this coming year, January 1. We had an RFP process, a bid process for that, and so we'll be bringing in a new managed care company to join the two others that are currently part of the process. But it's a partnership there, we're working with managed care companies that do this, frankly, nationally, as most states use managed care partners to deliver their Medicaid program.
You know, John, I wanted to ask you, this is a privatized healthcare system, as Jeff just said. Can you give us a little more detail about what that means and how typical this is for states across the country?
Certainly. No, it's a good question. So Medicaid programs look different in every single state. There's different degrees of penetration of managed care. Kansas has a very high percentage. About 96% of our members are in managed care. We even have laws on the books, statutes that says our CHIP program for children has to be in managed care.
And managed care, in a sentence, means?
Sure. It just means that care is being managed by a external insurance company, managed care organization that we contract with.
Yeah.
And I think one of the big things about the managed care model that's really that's driving a lot of inception across all states. I mean, just North Carolina is coming up with an RFP to go privatization with their states and look to the MCO model is two things. One is value-added benefits, and one is in lieu of services.
What does value-added benefits mean?
Sure. So today in Kansas, there is no adult dental benefit. That benefit is provided by the MCOs, which the state of Kansas does not pay for. So going forward in 2019, our managed care organizations will provide preventative treatments up to two a year, plus an additional $500 dental benefit, which could go towards restorative action. One of our MCOs is offering dentures through our frail elderly program.
Why would they offer it if it's not required?
Because managed care is all about treating the whole person health. And okay, these are things that, since they're not covered under the state plan, the managed care organizations realize that dental is a huge part of a person's well-being. It's a huge part of how they eat, how they socialize, how they interact, their ability to go out and gain employment. You know, it's a self-confidence thing, but it's also something that aids in their nutrition. You know, they eat healthy foods.
You know, Jeff, Kansas was given this three-year waiver from the traditional fee-for-service Medicaid model to operate Kansas as a demonstration project once upon a time. The state was later given a one-year extension, which is set to expire at the end of the year. With Governor Collier leaving office in January, does that change plans, derail plans to apply for another three-year waiver here?
No, I mean, clearly there'll be a change in governor. And so we are proceeding as, because our responsibility at KDHE obviously is to execute, manage the program. We'll be meeting with whoever's elected shortly after the election and talk about their direction they want to go, because with the likely there'll be some changes there. And so,
and perhaps some dramatic changes if Democrat Laura Kelly should win the race.
Could be. Could
be. The privatized system might be in jeopardy.
That's true. I would also tell you that we're already implementing changes for next year, however, back to the enrollment program for the better, and we can talk about that as the program goes on. So, but back to your question, clearly we're proceeding as we have been, and both John and I have been here about a year, and I know you mentioned the challenges. We think we've made a lot of progress this year, but at the same time, there's more to come, and we'll meet with the governor when that governor is elected and decide what direction we're going.
You know, John, Mercy Hospital down in Fort Scott, southeast part of the state, is just the latest small city hospital to announce its closing. Another 15 or more rural hospitals in Kansas have been identified as vulnerable to closing. What changes to CanCare can improve the finances and the viability of hospitals like that?
Sure. No, I think it's a great question. And I think it's not even exclusive to Kansas. I think we're seeing it across the U.S. This trend towards these rural hospitals that you were built around an inpatient model that now need to transition to more of an outpatient model just because how care is transforming.
But we're seeing this problem more in states that have not expanded Medicaid, according to the survey I just read.
Certainly. I mean, the states that not have expanded Medicaid, there is probably a higher uncompensated care. But even states that have expanded, those hospitals still have uncompensated care. But to address your question of what we can do, I think we need to look at new reimbursement models for these types of organizations, more of a value-based model that pays the hospitals, incentivize them to do things like transitions of care back to the homes. And also, they just need to look at their overall financial structure and see where their overhead is. If a lot of their overhead is wrapped up in inpatient beds, that's something that they're going to need to transition their model away from. And I know we've met with the Kansas Hospital Association, and we've even gone to Secretary Anderson went to Washington, D.C. to have conversations about how the rural hospital model needs to transform.
I was going to say, there is this conversation that traditional hospitals might be just too expensive for smaller communities in rural parts of the state, John.
Yeah, well, so let me just build on what John's comments were. So first, a comment about Fort Scott. My understanding is over 70% of the care they're delivering down there is on an outpatient basis. So it's important to understand what the ramifications there may be. As my understanding is a large majority of the care that's currently being delivered will still be delivered in that community. At the same time, the Kansas Hospital Association several years ago, or just a couple years ago, I should say, did a white paper titled "The Transformation of Rural Health in Kansas." And so, as was mentioned, we, KDHE, we've been having conversations with the leadership at the Kansas Hospital Association. In fact, we both went to Washington, met with CMS, who runs Medicare and Medicaid nationally, and we talked about the model of transforming, to your point, the rural hospital, which so much now can be delivered outpatient. Can they financially viably sustain themselves as an inpatient model? The most expensive hospital delivery system we have is that inpatient hospital model. And so we are excited about that opportunity with KHA and, frankly, with Washington, D.C., and coming up maybe a model not only that works for Kansas, but a model that could be something other states model ourselves after. So that's exciting, but it's clearly a need as just the dynamics of healthcare delivery have changed with technology and all that can be done both outpatient but also through telemedicine.
John, if we were to increase reimbursement rates to help those rural hospitals, is that a state legislative decision or a congressional decision?
Sure. That is a state legislative decision. So that would be something that we'd need an increase in our fee schedules, and that would be granted through the legislative budgetary process.
How much interest in the legislature is there when it comes to increasing those rates?
You know, I think there's some interest. I applaud Governor Collier because he did a 4% increase last year that we implemented.
Right.
So I think that he saw how important it was. I think it's something that we have to keep having discussions about as we figure out what our state budget looks like. I know in prior years it's been pretty tight, but if it loosens up a little bit, maybe that conversation can be had and some success there.
You know, you two guys, again, head this program, the Medicaid program in Kansas. Is it your recommendation that CanCare be expanded, that Medicaid be expanded? It's such a hot issue across the country. It's been a hot issue in Kansas. We've come close to expanding it in recent years. Is it time to expand it?
Sure. I'd love to address that question. I think that we're in a really unique environment right now. One of the things I think that's really important to recognize is after the last legislative session, we're under a current legislative proviso that we can't expand eligibility. We can't make significant changes to the program without legislative approval until at least July of next year. So right now, we're kind of in a holding pattern on this.
Medicaid expansion would change all that.
But it's actually against the law for us to go do that. Mm-hmm. So we would require some sort of a legislative action, which would have to be a bill that would have to be supported and passed. Plus, it'd be a budgetary implication. Even with the 90-10 match, that 10% would still have to be funded in our budgets, which once again will require legislative action.
But what I'm wondering is, as the two gentlemen who lead this program, is your recommendation, Jeff, that CanCare and that Medicaid be expanded in Kansas?
Well, when we were brought in, as you said at the top of the show, there were a lot of challenges. We've been focusing on the operational improvements we can make to deliver a better program to the state of Kansas. And I'll tell you, just this week, we had three educational enrollment programs with providers. We had six across the state, three different locations. And I was really encouraged because historically, because of the problems you identified early on, those were really tough, difficult meetings, both with the providers and with the Medicaid recipients. I attended those meetings, as did John this week, and the meetings went very smoothly. Mm-hmm. Clearly, again, the process isn't over, but the bulk of our focus as the agency that runs Medicaid this past year has been to improve the program for the benefit of the Medicaid members. We're doing that. We're not a legislative or political body. So again, whoever is elected as governor, we're in a position to move whatever direction that is. As you mentioned, there's arguments on both sides of of that equation.
You know, we've been hearing about CanCare problems for a while here, John. In April of 2017, legislative auditors were hired to investigate if CanCare was working. What did they find out?
So that LPA audit that they looked through, it was, and I have a background as a researcher, so I had a particular take on it. And it was a really hard question. Essentially, is CanCare good? And the way you go about kind of looking into that question, you really have to take into account what would have happened if we did not go with a privatized system and it was just fee for service. And that's really hard to do because of all the policies that have changed, all the legislative direction that we've had that increased, you know, services, which increased spending overall. Really what we found out at the end of it is they couldn't really conclusively say whether it was better or worse. And then I would just have to go back and reiterate, you know, that this idea of privatization of Medicaid is something that continues to expand across states. It is the growing trend because of all the things I mentioned before, that the spending in Medicaid is so limited to just medical care that states are recognizing that if they want to start incorporating social determinants of health, they want to start bringing in things that are outside of the Medicaid state plan, that this is one aspect and one way to do it.
And one of the issues here was the data wasn't good enough for the auditors to really make a judgment as to how effective the program was. And trouble with data is a common problem with Medicaid programs across the country, right?
Yeah, well, one of the first things John and I addressed when we came aboard was strengthening the data analytics team. So clearly there was a weakness there, and there, I think we've already gained the trust and respect of the legislative body given the work we've done this year in that area. So you're right. When that audit was done prior to our arrival, and they certainly uncovered problems. Now, I'd also like to make a comment. Your managed care privatization program, one thing we're doing at KDHE at the state of Kansas level, we are bringing parts of the application process back in-house. So a big part of the criticism of the Medicaid program has been the difficulty in getting potential Medicaid recipients onto the program, the application process to determine whether they're on Medicaid or not.
And this is working with a company called Maximus that proved to be problematic, right?
Well, so you're right. The state outsourced that program to Maximus, and it did not go well. We still have that relationship, but we made a decision, and effective at the beginning of the next calendar year here in January, the state will take back the training and quality portions of the eligibility application process, and then effective 7/1, effective in July of next year, the most difficult claims determinations are made for the elderly and disabled recipients, which has caused a lot of problems with the nursing homes because they're waiting. Is this person eligible for Medicaid?
Right.
We are taking those applications back in-house to the state, so the legislators, the Medicaid recipients, and frankly, even Maximus, very pleased that we're making those changes, those moves effective next year.
I'm just wondering, as we're sitting here having this conversation, if our listeners are just joining us, we're talking about the Medicaid program in Kansas. It's called CanCare. We're joined today by Jeff Anderson. He's a secretary for the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. He oversees the program. John Hamdorf is also here. He's the state's Medicaid director. You know, we're sitting here in our conversation today talking about reimbursement rates need to be higher. We're talking about folks not getting the coverage and the care they need. We're talking about rural hospitals closing. Wouldn't an expansion of Medicaid begin to deal with all of those problems in one fell swoop with a 90-10 federal match?
I think the way to look at this too is not just would it expand services to more individuals? Because if that's the question, if the question is would expansion expand services or expand eligibility to more individuals, it would.
And these lots of individuals who are really poor already. They just aren't poor enough to be in the Medicaid program.
Yeah, they currently don't meet the requirements that we have for our federal poverty limit. But I think also to Jeff's point and some other points being made, it would also be an influx of quite a few more people into the program. We were talking anywhere between 75,000 up to 125,000 in the latest estimate. And that would just mean that we would make sure that we need to have more providers, especially in the dental space. I know we have kind of a paucity of providers in that area, but providers would have to be, willing to accept more Medicaid patients. And once again, those reimbursement rates would still be an issue. It just would be there providing more services at still that lower rate. So I think it wouldn't solve the whole problem. It could be part of an overall strategy.
But to be crystal clear, a lot of these folks who would come into the program aren't getting any care now, and the care they do receive is oftentimes on an emergency room basis, right?
Well, I think that's a generalization because what we've seen in utilization is emergency room utilization has gone down and primary care visits have gone up. So we're seeing the correct trends. Inpatient hospitalizations have gone down. So that would lead me to believe that actually the program is working because it's getting people into those appropriate care settings versus higher uses of the emergency room or inpatient.
We were talking about the backlog and application delays a little bit ago here, Jeff, and I mentioned the company Maximus. There's a lawsuit involving Maximus these days. Has the state been well served through this privatized model in your view, or is it time to reconsider that based on your own professional judgment here? I know it's a political question, but there's also a professional aspect to it, too.
Well, two pieces to your question. Maximus handles the eligibility application process to get into Medicaid.
Correct.
Okay. So we're making a move, KDHE at the state of Kansas. We're bringing portions of that back in-house. Okay. So obviously, by that decision, we think we, the state, should control and run part of the program. The other piece to your question is the managed care piece, the privatization of actual administering the program in conjunction with KDHE. So, as John mentioned, the large majority of states across the country do have partnerships with managed care companies. These are companies with a tremendous amount of capabilities. They're Fortune 500 companies. Mm-hmm. For a state to go back and do all of that themselves, that would certainly be against the trend nationally, and it would be a very heavy lift from the state standpoint to replicate all the things UnitedHealthcare, Aetna. These are, again, yeah, Fortune 500 companies. So it's, I understand the question. We clearly, the program is working better than it did at its inception in 2013. We've articulated some of the improvements we're making. Again, we'll sit down with the new governor, lay out some of the options, and I'm sure they're aware of, they probably have some of their own ideas, and decisions will be made.
Well, just to be clear here, these big Fortune 500 companies that have come in to help with Kansas's Medicaid program, why did we get off such a rocky start then? These are experienced companies. They know what they're doing. There were all kinds of problems here. Folks couldn't get the care they needed.
Well, again, we were not here. I think, to be clear, I think the large majority of the problems were in the eligibility application process with Maximus.
The front end, you're
yes,
saying.
That we there were problems getting people onto the Medicaid program, you know, 3-6 month delays. Not necessarily once you're on the program, then you have your health insurance, the Medicaid program. I think that is – so people – your question's a good one, because we're in meetings with Medicaid members across the state, and they get very – you can, you're describing the complexity of healthcare in general.
Right.
And so I'm trying to draw a dichotomy between the eligibility process to get on to Medicaid and the actual functioning of the Medicaid program. We think the managed care programs in conjunction with KDHE are doing a good job.
So once people get the into the system and get the care they need, you're saying that portion of the program is going pretty well?
Yes.
Okay. CanCare, John, hasn't had an inspector general for since the previous one resigned back in 2014. What's been the delay? And is there a need for an inspector general for CanCare who can spotlight some of the issues we're talking about here today?
Certainly. And I do believe there's a need. I mean, these type of programs, the more oversight, the better. Honestly, Secretary Anderson and I have taken the approach, you know, if there is something that isn't perfect, then let's address it. Let's bring it up. Let's find the answers. Let's get it done. The reason why we don't have one right now is there was one identified. It's just they weren't confirmed by the Senate. So they essentially can't be in that role until there's a confirmation hearing and this person gets confirmed.
Jeff, there's another issue here. Governor Collier is pushing for a work requirement for his CanCare 2.0. You know, multiple studies have been done here that say that that would have little effect because most of the people on CanCare are already working or disabled. The legislature has given the administration the okay to explore the work requirement with the feds, but it said that the governor still need legislative approval to impose that condition. What's the likelihood of that work requirement going forward? How do you see that playing out?
Yes, John indicated, right now we can't make major changes to the eligibility side of Medicaid until July, so that's not going to be happening.
So nothing's going to happen till at least the midpoint of next year.
No, and then, as we've said multiple times, the new governors, whoever it is, will weigh in on that. So I really don't know what the likelihood, I mean, work going toward a work requirement. You're right, in the bid process for the managed care companies, we put that out there as something that we wanted to examine, as something we would potentially want to do down the road, but it will not be a 2019 implementation. So that's I think a wait for the new governor discussion.
Yeah, and just to touch on that too, because I've really spent a lot of time on this work requirement. I spoke to a lot of states like Indiana, so on and so forth, Arkansas. The thing about the work requirement is it has not been imposed yet in a state that does not have Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. So that is one thing that's interesting. The conversations with CMS, you know, are positive. They're positive, and you know, they're concerned that there is a cliff that people could hit when they start making too much money. But I think we have a real opportunity on one hand too, that there are a lot of people out there that want to get back to work, and we could provide services such as daycare for their children, such as helping them get their GED and some of these other things that could go along with a program like that. But we do need to be very responsible to make sure we're not injuring the people in the program.
You know, John, the enrollment opened this month. How long do people have to do that? How does that work right now?
Sure. So they'll get their enrollment packets coming here in October. They'll get a chance to review those. We've had hearings this week to walk people through the decisions they can make. They'll be able to make a decision which managed care organization they want to go with starting in January 1st, but then they'll also have an additional 90 days until April 3rd to change back and forth if they find out their provider's in a different network or if they want to have one of those value-added benefits that one company offers over the other.
And it sounds like the state is making this process a little easier for people to navigate.
You know, we heard a lot of really positive feedback that finally the state feels like they're opening and they're being honest and they're trying to share everything to make sure people can make the best decision for them or for their loved ones. And that's just good to hear that we're changing some of that culture.
Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our good guests for coming in today. Jeff Anderson, Secretary for the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. John Hamdorf, the Medicaid Director for KDHE. Gentlemen, thanks for all you do. Thanks for coming in today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate the time.
Time for a break. When we come back, why folks love basketball as much as they do. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we asked if the fight to stigmatize drunken driving could hold a key to success for activists looking to reduce gun violence. You can hear more at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, State Representative Brandon Ellington is raising alarms about prisoner treatment at the Crossroads Correctional Facility up in Cameron. We'll find out why. Well, Kansas City no longer has an NBA franchise, but it has diehard basketball fans, as anyone who's ever attended a game at Allen Fieldhouse can tell you. The good news for fans is that the NBA will open its 2018-19 season in just a few days on October 16. Well, to get you in shape for the season, there's a new book out, Basketball, A Love Story, that tells the story of the game through the men and women who've played it at a very high level. The book covers all manner of issues, the rivalry between the Celtics and Lakers, Wilt's 100-point game, the significance of Larry Bird and Magic Johnson to the game, the ABA, the blacklisting of Connie Hawkins, and a whole bunch more. ESPN is about to air a companion series by the same name, and just for the record, I just love this stuff. We're joined now by Rafe Bartholomew. He's one of the book's co-authors. This is his third book on basketball. He was senior editor of the ESPN website Grantland, hosted CNN's docuseries Hoop Nation, and is currently the features editor for the website Eater. He joins us now from KCSN in Northridge, California. Rafe, nice to have you. Good morning.
Steve, good morning. Thank you.
You have all these great quotes from many of the legends of the game about just how much they love the game. What struck me about it is these folks not just like the game, they really, really love it. There was a connection with it that instantly hit many of them when they were kids. What did you make of that?
Oh, that emotional side of this book and these interviews really, really connected with me. I grew up playing basketball. Mm-hmm. It really launched my career in a lot of ways just because I followed a basketball story across the world and it became my first book. And it's still the only thing that I still do almost every day is play basketball. I really can't live without it. And to read the greatest people to ever play and coach the game describing the same feelings and connection to the game, it's there, but to actually see the words or hear the words, man, it meant so much.
Magic Johnson said he couldn't go anywhere as a kid without a basketball.
Yeah, he calls it his girlfriend. And so does Mike Krzyzewski, Coach K. And it's true. I remember that's a classic Magic quote. He's been saying it for years, and I even did that in a couple of my high school years because Magic did it.
Huh. Why did you guys want to do this book now?
Well, we got the great opportunity to do the book because it actually began as this ESPN film, Basketball Love Story, which starts coming out on Tuesday nights, October 9th, for five straight weeks, 4 hours. The whole thing is 20 hours long.
Wow.
With all these interviews. And the director of the film, our co-author, Dan Clores, knew that even with 20 hours on the air, he was still going to be leaving out so much material. So that's when he approached myself and Jackie McMullen, the Hall of Fame basketball reporter,
right,
and said, could you please go through this stuff and find the best material to create an oral history book that acts as a companion and sort of brings out some of the stuff that the film can't get into. And I tell you, it was like they dropped the Dead Sea Scrolls of basketball on us.
Well, it struck me as an interesting time to do the book because many of the word original isn't the right word, but the very early pioneers of the game who made the game what it was. I'm talking about Bill Russell, Bob Cousy. You can still get those guys as well as talking, obviously, to the stars of today.
Absolutely. And it's an interesting moment for basketball because the NBA especially is so insurgent. It's one of the hottest sports in the country. People are constantly calling it the biggest growing sport and pointing to the way it blows up on Twitter and social media all the time. And that's great. It's leading to a lot of money and the growth of the sport and the interest is all huge. But it also makes it almost easier to forget the contributions of all these players over the years and the multiple generations and the stories of how Oscar Robertson and Jerry West helped lead the formation of the players union that kind of allows all the players today to make all this money. So in a way, it was a great opportunity at a moment when public interest is maybe higher than it's ever been in the sport of basketball to go back and tell a lot of the stories that made the game what it is today.
You know, you talked to so many of the biggest names in the game's history. Did you have a conversation with one of these folks that just stood out to you for whatever reason?
Oh man, it's impossible really to choose one. And this isn't an interview that I personally conducted, but the interview with Spencer Haywood is just amazing. I mean, he is such, his life, the way he tells stories. I mean, he grew up, as a son of sharecroppers in Mississippi in the Delta. And tells a story about how they wanted to play basketball when he was a kid, but his mother couldn't afford one. So she said, I'm going to make you one. And they said, how are you going to make a basketball? It has to bounce. And she took a croaker sack, so like a burlap sack, and stitched it together, filled it with cotton. And they had to play without bouncing, without dribbling. They had to two imaginary dribbles, and then they had to either pass or shoot. And there's so many stories like that in his interview. It really introduced him to me in a new way. And, man, I love him now.
Yeah, I was going to say that story was new to me, too. And it gave me a new appreciation for the great Spencer Haywood. And, again, that connection with the game, there's almost something inherent in his love for the game that he wanted to play so badly that he was willing to let his mom stitch together a ball for him.
Right. And it's not just, you know, there are stories from the great stories from some of the women pioneers. Nancy Lieberman, who grew up in New York City, tells a story of having to go through 7 or 8 basketballs when she was a kid because she was always dribbling in the house and driving her mom crazy. Her mom would take a nail and hammer it through the ball. Then she'd go to the closet and pull out a new one. I mean, people will do anything to play this game if they love it.
You know, speaking of Nancy, there are stories in here that I had forgotten about. And one of them was about Ann Myers, the UCLA great, who became the first woman to try out for an NBA team back in 1979. First, remind us who she was.
Sure. Ann Myers is one of the great all-time women's players and had this amazing career at UCLA, really made women's basketball big time, and that sort of led to her becoming a player that the Indiana Pacers were interested in. Now, the owner Sam Nassi at the time he admitted that there was a publicity stunt aspect to it, but it still was a once in a lifetime opportunity for Ann Myers to go there and really compete. And the way she talks about it in the book is, as a competitor, to say, look, I've played against women, but you always want to play at the highest level. And this was the NBA. With man or woman, that is the highest level of basketball. And she didn't make the team, but she represented herself well and really faced some tough comments from the players and coaches. The coach at the time of the Pacers was Slick Leonard, one of the all-time hard butt coaches in history of basketball. So that would have to be an intimidating atmosphere to go in, and she faced it and did well.
I was struck by the fact that Ann got a lot of flack for doing what she did, trying out for the men's team. A lot of people didn't like that.
Well, people, pioneers always get flack for stuff that when they're trying to go beyond what anyone has ever tried to do before. And of course it puts the men, the NBA players who are used to playing with each other in this man's world, puts them in a lose-lose position almost, because if they go too hard at Ann Myers in the tryout, then people yell at them for trying to pick on her because she's a woman. But if they let her score on her, then they'll make fun of them because they're like, oh, the lady beat you. And so the machismo, sort of baked-in misogyny made it a lose-lose, very difficult situation for everyone involved. And Myers handled it about as well as anyone could.
You know, one of the events, the seminal events that you guys talk about in the book is Wilt's 100-point game in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And it has this mythical sense about it because there were no TV cameras to record that game because it was played in this unusual location in Hershey. But you guys managed to find a man named Joe Rucklick, if I'm saying that right, who played a significant role in Wilt scoring 100 points. What was Joe Rucklick's contribution?
Yes, Joe Rucklick is one of the little unsung heroes in this book. The names that pops out, and you sort of a guy you've forgotten in history, but he comes alive here. And Joe Rucklick gave the pass to Wilt Chamberlain to score the 100th point. And it's not just a footnote in that respect, but it really goes deep into a relationship that they had, because 7 years before, in 1955, Joe Rucklick was chosen as the high school All-American center in an All-Star game. And he was the same year as Wilt Chamberlain, and he knew that Wilt was by far the superior player, right? But because of the situation of segregation at the time, it was an all-white, all-American team.
And Joe walked up to Wilt and actually apologized to him. It was just a great story.
When they ended up on the same team in Philadelphia, Joe Rucklick says, "You deserve to be there that day, and I'm sorry that I stood in your place." And Wilt says, "It's no problem, man." And from that point on, they were friends, and Rucklick got to go into the game and throw the pass that Wilt scored the famous 100th point on.
Rafe Bartholomew is my guest. His new book, Basketball, A Love Story. You also noted that Wilt sort of disappeared on the court in the final seconds of the game because he didn't want to score any more points after reaching 100. He thought 100 sounded a little better than 102. I think he probably had a pretty good point.
Wilt, his style, he always carried himself that way, right? I mean, from the cars, his fashion, he had that sense of the moment. And yeah, if you're going to get 100, you know no one's probably ever going to beat it. Might as well just keep that nice round number.
What did you learn about the storied rivalry between the Celtics and the Lakers, Rafe?
Oh, wow. Even though it is maybe the most historic rivalry, no, definitely the most historic rivalry in NBA history, and we all feel like we know so much about it, one of the moments that sort of gets forgotten, and it was really, really amazing, 1985, Pat Riley is talking about their finals when the Lakers beat the Celtics in six games, but that series began with the Memorial Day Massacre, like the Celtics destroying the Lakers, Kareem getting outplayed, and people saying the Lakers are done, Kareem is done. And Pat Riley says that if they had not won that series, he would have been fired. It was the most important. He calls game two when they came back and Kareem took over and sort of reestablished himself late in his career as a dominant player. He calls that the most important game in Lakers history because he thinks that Riley says that he would have gotten fired if they had lost that series, and maybe that whole dynasty falls apart. So that was one of those moments where you're like, wow, I never thought of it that way.
What does your book say about the Harlem Globetrotters?
So the ESPN film has a large, maybe 25-minute short film on the history of the Globetrotters, and probably touches on it in more depth than the book. In the book, there's a bit on how black players in the days of the NBA's quotas in the 50s, 60s, when there was an unofficial limit to the number of black players they'd put on an NBA roster, how the Globetrotters were one place where guys could go still play and make a living. And so it comes in and out of the book, but it's not a major point.
Do you guys do you want to take on the question of who's the greatest player of all time, LeBron or Michael?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because at the time we were working on it and putting together a chapter on Michael Jordan, I considered it not a very controversial opinion to call Michael Jordan the greatest player of all time. So the chapter on Michael Jordan is called The Greatest of All Time. And then shortly after we turned it in, the media blew up over the question and they started coming up with new arguments for why LeBron may eventually overtake him. Look, if it happens, it happens. Great. They're both absolutely great. But to me, it's hard to ever imagine a greater player than Michael Jordan.
You know, Missourians on both sides of the state here have clamored for a pro team for years, but it hasn't happened. What's a city got to do to get a team? Because do you see an expansion team or two in the near future in the NBA?
A lot of people argue that the NBA could expand to 32 teams sooner rather than later. I don't know, in the next 5-10 years. It really just takes money. You need some rich guy, pick the one of the richest men in the Kansas City area, and if they are committed to supporting an NBA franchise, I think you're right that the basketball culture in the area is strong enough to support a team. It's just you need someone to come in and drop the huge bag of money.
You know, just to wrap things up here, if you move past Golden State, you know, it's going for its fourth title in 5 seasons. Is there any question that team's not going to win the championship this year?
Well, I'm on the conservative side of these arguments where I like to say, let them play the games. I think that if Golden State stays healthy, they are going to be a prohibitive favorite. But time catches up with teams. It's really hard to keep playing that enormous, long schedule year after year, going back to the finals. You don't see it happen very often, and weird things happen. Teams get tired of each other. We've seen a little bit of friction over there in Golden State. I think you have to expect them to win because they are that great. They're that talented. They have multiple Hall of Famers on the team, being coached by a guy who played for Phil Jackson and Greg Popovich.
Right.
But you never know. That's why they play the games, right?
The book is Basketball, A Love Story. Look for the ESPN series opening up next Tuesday, right, Rafe?
That's right. Next Tuesday, the film will be on ESPN2 at 9 p.m. and it will then play the following 4 Tuesdays, so 5 straight Tuesdays in a row. And it's already online if you want to look for it there.
Rafe Bartholomew is also a former classmate of KCUR's new Missouri reporter Samuel King, who says hello, Rafe, and who knew? Sure appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Tomorrow we find out why one state rep is calling attention to a correctional facility up in Cameron. And it's Friday. For a little fun, we'll meet the band Thunder Pussy. You don't want to miss it. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.